I haven't even really got an opening joke for this week. The sprint was just crack cocaine. Welcome back to Motorsport 101.
Yes, Mr. Harrison, did you enjoy your peanut butter and crack sandwich that was everything about that sprint?
Yes, my new name is Dre Tyrone Biggums Harrison after that effort. Good Lord. Welcome to episode 651 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Tyrone Biggums. And Jesus Christ, what a weekend that was. That really was like a crack binge, and then having the mother of all come downs on Sunday afterwards, because boy, what a weekend we had. And so much to talk about in a weird sort of way, also very little to talk about. It's kind of strange how a weekend can be like the Oscar winner, everything everywhere all at once. Joining me to discuss it all over the next 45 minutes or so is Mr. Cameron Buckley. Hello, mate.
Hello, everyone. I regret to inform the masses that we are now in a post-Carson Hocevar race winner world. I was right about this earlier in the season, and I'm not quite happy about it, if I'm being honest. He is the ultimate sim racing reckless driver's driver. He's very fast. He also has never had a neuron fire in his head. It's honestly kind of fun to watch.
Yeah, it's like going back to, what if we put Captain Caveman in the NASCAR and see what happens? And, you know, turns out the speed was always there. It was everything else. It was a tricky bit.
Right. Along with the fact that current Beat Him Down Excellence Award front runner Tyler Reddick crashed in this race, as did, well, everyone. We had the gargantuan one, the record breaker. A couple cars short of the sport ender. Well, he still extended his points lead at the front. So, you know, them know your next move.
I've heard multiple people talk about this. I think this may have been 28 cars involved in one NASCAR 31. Wreck. 31 was the official number. Dear God, it was. That is literally, God, I want to say, for times in it by what, 2.5? So that's a call that 75% of the field, nearly.
It was an expensive day. Usually days at Talladega are, but this one especially.
Carson Hocevar wins in a car that's ready for the dumpster.
This was one of the few that wasn't, along with his incredible victory celebration that definitely has to win some kind of M101 award at the end of the year. We'll make something up. We'll fuck it. We'll do it live.
Yeah, the Carson Hocevar celebration award. Yeah, something like that. It was.
Incidentally, we got another one of those out of the weekend from one Mr. Mark Marquez, because, at least for a fleeting moment, Our bikes!
Briefly.
It didn't last.
No.
It lasted for some members of the Harrison household.
Yes, a Marquez brother is back in the winner's circle, but not the one people were expecting. Not the first time I've said that in the last 18 months. So we'll talk about that. Alex Marquez, back-to-back Spanish Grand Prix wins at Jerez. It was his first MotoGP win there last year. He's had a couple more to add to his collection since then, but he's gone back-to-back in Jerez. He really is that is a man where if you get the right track with him, he really does perform. But we'll talk about that race. We'll talk about the absolute ridiculous crack-inducing sprint. Probably the greatest sprint in the history of motorsports, let alone MotoGP. I don't think there's been any sprint race that will ever top that one for insanity. And how Marc Marquez crashed and that actually helped him win the race. That needs some explanation. We'll get to that very shortly.
No further context. You can leave it there.
Exactly.
What a silly weekend.
City weekend, so of course Mark then crashes on lap 2 of the actual Grand Prix at 110 miles an hour at turn 11, because nothing in this sport makes sense anymore. That happened. Ducati is on the board. Are they actually giving Aprilia something to think about? where the hell is KTM in all this? And turns out the Concorde Agreement might actually be in some jeopardy. We'll talk about all of that over the next 45 minutes or so. But before then, here's the places you can find us as ever. We're on youtube.com/motorsport101. We're on facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on Twitter at motorsport_101 for to follow us on our personal handles. You can see Buckley917 for him, Dre Harrison for me. Instagram and TikTok, if you want some highlights of the show and some bonus content, you can do so over there. Motorsport101 pod for Instagram, M101_podcast on TikTok. And if you really, really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our content. You can upgrade to the $10 tier to listen to these episodes on Riverside Live as they're being recorded, which Jason, Ghost Raptor, and Vic are doing right now. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Much appreciated for the support as ever. And you can also check all those details out on our website, motorsport101.com, including a full written review from yours truly on that crack fest. I don't know how I got my head off the deck to be able to actually write it, quite frankly, but we've
run out of gold stars.
Yeah, that was a first. I had to get an extra packet out from my sister's pencil case of school equipment, as you do. I had to break the Dave Meltzer review score rating system, as you do. That's one for you wrestling fans out there. Right, without further ado, let's get into the Spanish Grand Prix.
Well, in a sentence, we have to start with the most ridiculous sprint in MotoGP history. Marc Marquez, the pole sitter, took the early lead with brother Alex giving chase after clearing Johan Zarco, the walking-talking definition of Unk Still Got It in the Honda camp. Fantastic weekend. Who started second? Alex was able to reel in his brother at half distance, passing him for the lead, right as the white flag came out for a slippery track with the rain coming down. That rain intensifies with 6 laps left, with Marc Marquez crashing after passing the pits and falling at the final corner, now raining heavily. But he keeps the clutch in, picks up the bike, crosses the track as the leading group comes back through, and enters the pits to change bikes. Alex Marquez then crashes from the lead, with Zarco running wide through the gravel. Brad Binder, first time we've been able to talk about him in a little while, running wide from the lead. Fermín Aldeguer couldn't survive on slicks either. It left Pecco Bagnaia leading as the first one to switch until Marc Marquez slams it down the inside of his teammate to lead.
Brutal move.
Yeah, the block pass doesn't even begin to describe it. He takes the lead and wins just the most absurd sprint race any of us have ever watched. Kree, what the fuck was that?
I don't know. It's been 4 days, and I still am not entirely sure what I actually witnessed.
We watched this as a crew, and all of us are just sitting in the chat, mouth agape, because we can't comprehend what's going on in front of us.
There was at one point, I think about 6 different people could have won this, and look. This was the short version of the description. I didn't even mention Jorge Martin's front brake failed. Something jammed in it on the opening lap, and he had to basically DNF after 2 laps because his front brake failed. Marco Bezzecchi actually rode off. He did a Marc Marquez from Phillip Island 2024. He rode over Alex Marquez's tear-off that fell off the front of his fairing and landed under his rear tire. We haven't even mentioned that in that description. That was before the real chaos happened. It was already a freaky sprint. Then the rain came down. And then all hell broke loose.
You want to make these silly bikes exciting? Just add water. Really is that simple sometimes.
This was the MotoGP sprint equivalent of the end of David Tennant's run of Doctor Who, where he looks up to the sky and he says, Gallifrey is descending. That's what this was. The rain comes down, and Alex himself, because the thing is, right, when these situations happen, the front is the one place you don't want to be, because you're the guinea pig. You're the first one through. Toby Moody said that on his golden Eurosport era days as commentator, he'd always say that the last place you want to be is at the front of the field because you're the first one through. And that lap where Mark crashes is the first lap the rain is really heavy, to the point where the slicks can't handle it.
They were Alex's bike jumps in that final turn and he's able to gather up. Mark just low sides it immediately, and pretty much everyone from that point forward is like, well, okay, we've left it a lap too late, because the rain just came crashing down. It almost got to Colic conditions.
By the time it got to the end, I was like, if they red flagged it and called it early, I wouldn't have blamed them. It was horrendous by the end of that race. It was monsoon conditions. You thought we were in Indonesia or some shit. Like Maddox said after the race, he reckons it was about 30 seconds too late. Like, if that rain had come 30 seconds earlier, they would have all come in. It was one of those where it came down as they were coming through Crivier Corner, and by that point, you've probably already committed to staying out in your head, at least mentally.
Yeah.
And everybody did, really. There was only the midfielders that were coming through late did they have the awareness to go, okay, this is too heavy. They were already doing like 141s in the dry. They were tiptoeing around, even the lap beforehand that this was coming in.
We were already like nearing the crossover point, but the track wasn't wet enough across the track to then commit to the wet tires. You just go and destroy them. And then it's like you just flip a switch and suddenly it is heavy rain in the final turn.
Yeah.
And I guess we have to talk about the silliest part of all of this. Mark Marquez didn't win despite crashing. He won because he crashed.
It is miraculous that so many things about this could have gone wrong. If one little thing about this goes wrong, his race is over. Mm-hmm. But everything ended up just about perfect. Yes, he tucks the front going through the final corner. The nature of Jerez is actually quite fortunate in that, and this is something to explain because a lot of people immediately got on the internet and was like, oh, Mark's cheated, or, well, he's had to have broken a rule. And, well, to be fair to our friends at Crash, the people that I now work for, we had a direct line to Simon Crafar. So we asked him directly,
is this cool?
And they came back with a communication document that was like, no, it's all good, and allow me to quickly explain. So the situation is that Jerez is quite unique as a track. It's the only real track, I think, on the calendar that's got this sort of layout where the pit lane doesn't have a wall in between. It starts right at the top of the actual main straight itself. There is no commitment line in MotoGP, unlike Formula One, where once you're past the white line for entry, you're committed to coming into the pits. MotoGP does not have that rule. The only rule it has is you are not allowed to cut the inside white line when you come into the pits.
Effectively cutting the pit entry as a shortcut.
Yes, that patch of the track is green, i.e. you cannot cut it. It would be deemed as a track limits penalty. You can't cut that. Mark did not do that. Was it dangerous? No, it wasn't. For the reason of, well, first of all, he had no marshal assistance, so there was no instructions for him to ignore because he didn't get help returning the bike to the pits. As we mentioned in the description, the clutch was held in.
He kept the engine going. You're not allowed to restart the bike this year with outside assistance. Once the engine's off, that's it.
Yeah, it's a rule that's already come up in Moto 2 because it was Angel Piqueras earlier this season was the first person to break it. You are not allowed to restart your bike on the side of the track anymore. You have to be in a service road before they restart you now. So if you break that rule, it's a double long lap penalty. That's happened to Piqueras in Moto 2. Get well soon, by the way, big mate, because we didn't realize at the time that he had his leg and ankle broken from that absolutely horrific Fernandez crash in Austin in the Moto 2 field. We didn't know at the time, but Piqueras had broke his leg. Horrible, horrible crash. Get well soon, Angel. On that note, there was no outside assistance. That was a perfectly legal thing to do. The clutch was kept in. He waited for all the other bikes in the lead group to make their decision. He did not cross the track until it was clear. Johann Zarco got very bitchy about this, saying,
understatement.
That man ran to French television, went to Canal Plot, and basically was like, guys, he went backwards on the live track. No, he didn't. We have the onboards. He did not go backwards on a track. That would be, if he did, then I'd all have been like, yeah, that's dangerous.
Justified penalty.
Yeah, he did not do that. As mentioned, that wall for the Jerez pit entry is, you can go past the exit and you still haven't hit that wall yet. So he did not cut any part of the track in terms of a shortcut in order to make his pit stop. As long as you hit the timing loop, you're good, quite frankly. And that's exactly what happened. So for people that are mad about this, he broke no rule in the book. Everything was above board. The only things that he could have been flagged up for was cutting the track on the inside on entry and cutting the white line on exit. He did neither of those things.
Yes, in the words of Winston from John Wick, he has breached no legalities. And yeah, from there, it's Marc Marquez in Heavy Rain. And what did you think was going to happen? He just blasted Pecco out of the way, frankly speaking, and then took off up the road. And in the meantime, Brad Binder was the leading rider who had switched and just got it wrong in the rain and went wide and had to pick the bike back up himself.
This was screaming for a Brad Binder victory. One, he's won many sprints like this before. Hell, his last Grand Prix win was the embodiment of chaos, riding slicks on a very wet track in Austria and just about winning that one. It would have been the first even podium finish for Brad Binder of any kind since the opening weekend in Qatar in 2024. That's how long a dry spell Brad Binder's had. Mm-hmm. And he had a golden chance to win this one, and sadly, he blew it. He would come back and he would finish, I believe, in fourth place in the end. But it was not to be. It should have been a win, quite frankly. Alex Marquez got it wrong, and then he crashed on a wet track on slicks at turn 8.
Trying to nurse it back to the pits, and... I mean, the second he put any lock into the front of the bike, it just tipped him down.
Yeah, no chance. Johann Zarco had a very similar near miss, went ran straight on, but was able to save it and keep it going. By the time it all shook out, we, for a split second, thought Pecco Bagnaia might actually win this sprint, which, if Pecco Bagnaia, who we all know has not been very good in sprints, we'll have a sprint win and a sprint second place. Like, Bagnaia has low-key been robbed of two sprint wins this year, which is quite funny how this is shaken out so far this season.
Imagine saying that 2 years ago, huh?
not a hope in hell. It's funny how these things turn out. But, Pecco Bagnaia, sprint specialist all of a sudden this season. Who'd have thought it? But no, Mark plowed his way through, got to the front, broke out a couple of seconds in the lead, and basically didn't look back. So what an absolutely apocalyptically chaotic sprint. And I thought Austin was crazy. Austin was like this a five-star sprint.
Yeah, this is that plus Walter White's Blue Sky.
It was
99.1% pure nonsense.
It was an unbelievable spectacle to watch in real time. I literally said, what in the cinnamon toast fuck was that? My crash.net cohort, Lewis Duncan, said respectfully, what the fuck was that sprint? Neil Morrison was like, that was fun.
David Emmett and his Discord, I fucking love flag to flag races.
Simon Patterson, I hate flag to flag races.
Of course he does.
I don't care for his opinion. You like the Isle of Man TT, unironically, get bent. You want to talk about shit being too dangerous and you love that race. Everything else below that is fine, quite frankly. But no, it's... Society's too busy reading fan fiction for that right now, anyway. And beyond that...
Moving on!
No, it was... I mean, I love my favorite tweet about all of this came from Julian Ryder. And Cam will know exactly what I'm talking about here.
I've not actually seen this.
Oh, no, no. I'll tell you exactly what he said. Because after the sprint was over, he gets on Twitter and he makes mention of that the Frankie Morbidelli was third. His first podium finish of the season. That also happened. Like Frankie was one of the first guys to switch, and it paid out for him. Frankie Morbidelli came in further, and Julian Ryder on Twitter said, I think it's very cool that Frankie Morbidelli has dedicated his sprint podium to all the people out there that are suffering. It must be really nice for him to be thinking of Yamaha's riders in this trying time.
That's
oh man.
In terms of shots fired, that's a mortar thrown out a window.
Yeah, torpedo towards HMS Yamaha, right through the piano. Yeah,
honestly, if you put two wheels on one of their pianos, I think you'd actually be faster in a straight line at this point.
Probably.
That bike is putrid. Toprak also with a save of the year contender in practice. I don't know how he almost saved that thing.
That was a crash. No, I'm not, it just didn't hit anything. I'm not even sure how we even call that a set. That was a crash. He was 67 degrees sideways.
He picked it back up.
Picked up at his knee, and I'm like, Gino Borsoi couldn't believe what he'd just seen. It was like, oh, yeah. Like it was ridiculous. That's already safe of the year right there. Mark Marquez afterwards was like, yeah, it's a hell of a safe.
Well, he would know.
He's had a few like that. It was the Johan Zarco at Austin when he was at Avincia save. I think Laurie Spaz had one of those.
God.
I think Baz had one of those that was quite similar, where it's just like in Austin where he just picks the whole thing up via his knee and is able to actually save it. Ridiculous. Absolutely crazy. It helps when you're 6'1". And you just got long levers to just pick everything up in case it happened. But no, an absolutely outrageous sprint. If you have not seen it, go out of your way to do so. You do not even need to be a MotoGP fan to understand what the hell just happened. It is must-see television, quite frankly.
Easy. If we're calling race of the year right now, it's that, and it's everything else is a mile off. That was insanity.
Yeah, not even close. Yeah, so that is an 11 out of 10. Are you fucking kidding me? Level race. Even if it's only a sprint. I'm not sure if that counts for race of the year, but I'll allow it, quite frankly. The actual Grand Prix itself on Sunday, much tamer affair. Sun was out, not a cloud in the sky. Weather was perfect. And it was an entirely much calmer affair. Marquez took the whole shot again, but this time Alex came through quickly. He slammed his way past through Marco Bezzecchi into turn 10 to get into second on the opening lap, ending Marco Bezzecchi's 121 consecutive laps led streak from the last six race weekends.
Yeah, it's really good for him that doesn't include sprints, because he has been woeful in sprint trim.
6 points in sprints all year. We've had four of them. Out of a possible 48 points, Bez has had six. Funny that. So Alex Marquez on lap two passes Mark down the hill towards Pedrosa hairpin, takes the lead. Mark follows him through, and by the time he gets to turn 11, huge crash. About 110 miles an hour through turn 11, through Crivier corner.
First you die, and then you pay taxes. And then the Ducati tucks the front.
We've heard this one before. Fast one, thankfully, rider okay. Bike absolutely wasn't. Beyond that, it was an extremely tame race. Alex Marquez pushed that lead out to about 2.2 seconds at its longest. Ends up winning by about the same margin, 1.9, I think it was, over the line in the end, ahead of Marco Bezzecchi in second. And another podium for Fabio Di Giantonio in third. So Ducati is on the board. First win of the year for them. It's a strange one to think about this, because you can kind of tell, like, Ducati was kind of happy that, obviously they were happy that Alex Marquez won. They're happy that they've got a win on the board. but it feels kind of almost like a punch to the nuts, because both factory Ducatis failed to finish. Mark had that crash. Francesco Bagnaia had some kind of technical problem. We think it was probably the engine braking wasn't working properly, because he was talking about wheel spin in his...
Couldn't slow the bike down, and it just kept getting worse and worse until he had an kind of like a minor off, and then he called it from there, because it seemingly at that point the bike was no longer safe to ride.
Yeah, that is now going back through the last 9 race weekends, going back to Bagnaia's crazy win at the Japanese Grand Prix last year. The factory Ducati team has not had a podium finish in a Grand Prix since then. It's their driest spell since 2014.
Well, it's not like Ducati were in a bit of turmoil in 20. What do you mean they were a claiming rules team?
Yeah, they were back then. They were a claiming rules team to try and help speed up their development from how much they were struggling, and they were a full blown factory.
Yeah,
that's the last time Ducati's been off the podium this long.
Not great. And yeah, I mean, we rewatched that crash a dozen times each across like all the Discord, and he just doesn't do a whole lot wrong. The front just goes.
Mark himself said, yeah,
Davide thinks Augusta Wynn got him.
Yeah, we think that's probably the most logical explanation, because Mark said he didn't understand it at all. He admitted, because when he crashed last year, and that was at turn 8, he admitted he'd gone too quick. He'd gone in too hot. He was desperate. He was trying to chase his brother down. He was kind of in shell shock a little bit, and he just overcooked it and crashed. He was like, yeah, held my hands up. I went in too quickly, made a mistake. This one, as you said, it didn't actually look like he'd done all that much wrong. He makes the apex fine. There's no understeer or anything like that. The front just goes, and it's one of those ones that's really hard to explain. There's no obvious moment where it's like, oh, he's gone in too fast. It's just the front just goes, and it's hard to crash at turn 11. That's a tricky corner to crash, because it's very straightforward. It's a one line corner.
It's a fast sweeper.
It's a fast sweeping right. I know Mark's never liked those post arm injury, but even so, you're not crashing at that corner very often unless something really has gone wrong. And this was not one of those occasions, but it's got a lot of people nervous about Mark. And the situation in the championship is not ideal. He's now 44 points behind Marco Bezzecchi in the standings through 4 weekends. Not a disaster. This is salvageable, but a lot of...
We're only really about 10% into the season from a points perspective.
There's still 666 points available. This is hardly a disaster, but it's got a lot of journalists. I saw a lot of people on social media saying this could be the beginning of the end for Mark, and what have you. And a lot of people are concerned that this is the beginning of the end. And I don't think that's the case. I think a lot of people are overly concerned because it's Mark. He is the star. He is the biggest name in this sport now by a country mile.
And what standard did he set last year? But hey, as long as he keeps the bike on the road, he will either finish second or win, usually by an absolutely violent margin over everyone else.
And I think that's the difference between last year and this year. First of all, I need to point this out. Mark's injury was a ligament injury. If his injury happened to you or me, we'd be in a cast and a sling for months. We wouldn't be doing
six, forgive the meme, 6 to 7 months is usually the ballpark of you coming out of the sling. Let alone using it, let alone riding a 330 horsepower carbon fiber piss missile.
Yeah, a bike that's got about 2,000 brake horsepower per ton. If this was any normal human being, we'd have been in a sling for 6 months. Let alone trying to race a motorcycle on it. And I think that's the real concern. Mark said to the media he felt better in that arm, obviously because we had 4 weeks between this and Austin as a Grand Prix. I also need to point out
some pictures, Dre. You see the surface of that arm now, as opposed to what it looked like in Coda.
There's a gash.
He's got a bite. He's got a bite out of his arm, like a shark on him.
Yeah, it's a huge gash from that crash in Austin. That was a 115 mile an hour crash down the hill, to say the least. No, he's dinged up. And again, we talked about this before. We all underestimated the nature of this injury. We all initially.
They did. Remember, they announced, like, yeah, we're not going to do surgery. We're just sitting him because, hey, there's nothing to play for. He'd already clinched the title.
Mm.
As it turns out, this did require surgery. The surgery was done late, which can cause its own complications, both in terms of healing, but in terms of just extending the recovery time. Had he been operated on the next day, let's say this is, like, actually, no, he does have to try and come back to win last year's title to at least seal it. Mm. Like a Maverick situation. He probably gets it done the next day, and he's that much further into that recovery period now. But that's not the world we're in, and he's still in that recovery period. The biggest thing I would say on raw speed, Mark was absolutely flying this weekend, which he was not the first couple weekends of the year. The big concern for me is the early race pace, and that's the case with both factory Ducatis. They just aren't comfortable. They're not one with the bike on high fuel on cold tires.
Yeah, I've always had a theory about this for some time. I talked about it on Twitch the other night. I do occasionally do Twitch streams, twitch.tv/Harrison101. Keep an eye on my socials. I tend to be quite short notice with them, but they do happen. The difference is that we've talked about this before. Ducati makes their money on rear grip. They are incredible when it comes to rear grip and pushing the back of the bike into the ground. That's where Ducati makes their lap time.
Braking and getting that engine, that big, beautiful engine, to the ground.
The problem with that is that sometimes, and this is going to sound weird, they have too much rear grip. And when you have too much rear grip and the rear starts pushing into the ground too much, it actually overloads the front of the bike. It unsettles the front because the front can't handle the amount of force that's going through it due to all that cornering speed. That force has to go somewhere. And that's what's led to Marc Marquez being a bit nervous about riding a fully fueled Ducati. 21 liters of fuel inside the bike. You know, if it's water, it's 1-to-1 in terms of it doesn't have 20 kilos of fuel. Not to mention cold tires coming through. It makes it a lot easier to tuck the front and crash. So Mark, and he did this last year as well to an extent, where he's taking it easy for the first half dozen laps, waiting for some of that rear grip to go down so that Mark can then start pushing, because at that point he knows the rear isn't going to overload the front and cause a crash. There's another factor in this. Mark has only done one full race distance since October. And he still has only done one because of what happened here in this race, because he crashed on lap two. And for me, that's another factor that comes into play into this. And there's one more factor. This is the biggest outside threat Ducati has had since 2022. Mm-hmm. When it was Fabio Quartararo, and he dominated the first half of the championship that year. We all know the story. When Pecco Bagnaia crashed from, I think it was the lead in the German Grand Prix, he was 91 points behind Fabio Quartararo that year, and it was only down to Ducati finally getting their shit together on top of a monumental collapse from the Japanese factory internally that same year that led to Bagnaia coming back and winning his first MotoGP title. Since then, no outside manufacturer has even come close to what Ducati has been putting out. Now, Aprilia has given Ducati a bloody nose. That's more than obvious. Say what you will about Aprilia, Marco Bezzecchi was 1.9 seconds behind Alex Marquez at the flag. That's less than a tenth a lap.
This was the final. The reason why I noted this as the final test when we last talked is because everyone has a million laps of this track.
Mm-hmm.
There is no more known quantity than Jerez. And on the evidence of this, they were basically blow for blow with one another. Ducati did bring some new odds and ends here. They did appear to speed the bike up. But on the factory bikes, we'll never know what their race pace was like because Beko's failed and Mark's crashed. But on this evidence here, it's going to be pretty track dependent, honestly. Because they make almost the same lap time, but they do it in very different ways.
Yes. Aprilia performs best when it's hot. They can get their tires going quickly. They have excellent downforce across their bike. And they are very, very good now at loading the front of the bike without those problems. And they're just a very good all-round machine now. They haven't really got a discernible weakness anymore. They can now load up their bike with downforce and not worry about tire wear or losing grip late race or butchering their tires. That's not an issue for them anymore. They've solved that issue. Ducati is still fast. They still have unbelievable rear grip, but getting their tires up to speed has typically been their biggest problem in the last year and a half of their dominance. Alex Marquez was fantastic in this Grand Prix, but Alex Marquez's form is very track dependent. This is not the Alex Marquez of last year where he was challenging for wins right from the gate, right out of the gate and right from the get-go.
This is the first time he's even really appeared at the front to this point.
Yeah. The most consistent Ducati has been Fabio Di Giannantonio. And he's not winning races. He's challenging for podiums. He's not had any major mistakes or bad days, really, but he's not at the peak of the field. That's an issue. And I know Fabio basically wanted to say, we took the development of the bike too much into Mark's direction. There's no real evidence of that.
No, because Mark rejected the GP25 when he got there. That just sounds like Digia gets paid by a certain man. And that friend with benefits relationship happens to involve saying shitty things about Mark Marquez. Probably in there somewhere in the contract, if we're being honest.
It wouldn't surprise me. And I like Digia. He's a solid human being, and I've not really got any personal issue with him whatsoever. It was just a very weird and almost flippant comment, because a lot of people seem to think that Mark Marquez is this dominant force that dictates development. He doesn't. He never really has in his career, certainly not at Ducati. And let's not forget, they had Danny Pedrosa at Honda for a good few years, even after Marquez had joined. And it's no coincidence that Honda's issue started the moment Pedrosa retired.
Forget that. They started... Mark did define some development of the 2015 Honda, and the thing was a mess. However, he then was telling them, hey, bike's a mess, for another 4 years while it got worse and worse and worse.
Mm.
And then he wasn't there to develop the 2022 Honda. How did that go for Honda?
Dreadfully.
It still stinks. Hey, at least Mir finished a fucking race this weekend.
Good
job, buddy.
Is that before or after the double long lap penalty he had to get for leaving debris on a live track and not respecting the meatball?
You gotta respect the meatball, man. If you're not gonna respect any flag in racing, you gotta respect the meatball.
Yeah, they can't all be perfect. No, my overall conclusion is the sample size is way too small on this. And like as many people will tell you, the MotoGP season only really begins in Europe, and this is the first European race and arguably the most conventional track that we go to for MotoGP.
Jerez will typically kind of set you up for what you're looking for the next 8 to 9 rounds.
Yeah, and Ducati were very bullish after the Monday's test. Davide Tardozzi genuinely thinks they've got something now that can take the fight. His words was, I believe, was take the fight to Aprilia. And it's
almost turning into a little bit of, you know, your 2024, if we were to compare this to F1, please put the gun down, motorcycle racing fans, please. It's very much like what the 2024 Red Bull and McLaren fight turned into, where the McLaren just kind of works everywhere, and then the Ducati is still very fast, still the fastest bike in peak conditions, but it's a lot harder to nail down its setup window. If they can widen that just to get it to the point where the factory boys can get it to work early on in the race, they'll probably be fine.
Yeah.
And the bigger thing with that is the more time we go on, as long as Mark doesn't re-injure that same ligament in the shoulder, he will continue to get better. Yeah, and this is in terms of raw speed, especially in qualifying, that's the best he's looked all year. It's a question of getting the early race in a better position.
Yeah, and he's got time to still figure this out. I'm not on the more cynical side that a lot of people are on this one. Like, this is the same man who racked up 15 in a row last year. I'm not saying, I don't think that'll happen this year, because I think Aprilia is too good for that. I think there will be days where Aprilia will just lead from the front and not be touched. We've already seen that this year already multiple times. But it leads us to a fascinating sort of season. And let's not forget, Marco Bezzecchi has easily left 15 to 20 points on the table due to his poor sprinting. Like, yeah. Bez has been phenomenal in Grand Prix. Jorge Martin has been excellent as well this season. He's only 11 points behind.
I was about to bring that. Get out of my head, Dre. Honestly, it's not even any good Wi-Fi in here. No, like, the more I look at Martin, the more I wonder if he's the true threat as well. Because every time he tests and every time he races, he looks better and better on this bike. There's going to be a point where if Martin can get back to anything like that old ceiling, Aprilia might start taking points off each other.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be the first time that Marquez has won a championship via an external threat beating each other up. That's exactly how he won it in 2016 when the last year of Rossi and Lorenzo as teammates.
Yeah, those two both died on that hill, and Marquez beat them both on a bike that was, could charitably be called a shitbox.
Erratic, I think the fair.
It was not a good bike. No. 2017 and 2018 were a lot better, and they still were not perfect.
Indeed. So it's setting up a fascinating season right now. Mark's got a deficit to make up. Everybody still thinks he's the best rider in the world when he wants to be, but he's now got a mountain to climb for the first time in a little while. Marco Bezzecchi's been fantastic on Sundays. He's been woeful on Saturdays. Jorge Martin, the ceiling's not quite as high, but he's got a lot more consistency in his game, like he had when he won the world title in 2024 in the back half after that crash in Germany, where he then treated second place like the floor for the rest of the season. It's setting up a fascinating title fight, and I look forward to seeing how this goes down. We do have Le Mans next week, after all.
Oh, I love Le Mans.
I love Le Mans, and as Jason points out, because he loves the new average finish stat, because I told him that, Jorge Martin has the best average finish in the field so far overall, once you factor in the sprints and Grand Prix.
Yeah, funny that. He'd probably be even closer without the mechanical in the sprint, because he was fighting for the podium until his front brake failed.
I think if he doesn't mention average finish between every 6 hours, I think he melts. Anyway, the other big story getting out of MotoGP this weekend, before we get out of here, it seems that these talks about the Concord agreement is the reason why we've not had any of the rider deals announced going into 2027. Everybody thought, okay, the reason why this is why nothing's been made official yet is because the manufacturers are sitting down with Dorna / MSEG to basically thrash out a F1-style Concord agreement where everybody's on the same page, because their current agreement expires at the end of this year. It looks like that deal is on the brink of jeopardy.
Well, how do you negotiate if the people who you're negotiating with simply choose to not show up?
It's not great. Credit to Motorsport Network and Yaman Casanova Garcia for writing the story on this initially. It came through today. There was meant to be talks about a potential Concorde agreement coming through in Austin, and it turns out that most of the major players involved shunned that meeting.
Yeah, the only people of the manufacturers who showed up were Alberto Puig with Honda and one of their press secretaries. It was actually two of them with Honda, two of their press crew there. And Davide Tardozzi of Ducati and their communications. No one else. Aprilia, KTM, and Yamaha all just decided not to show up, and they would refuse any discussion.
From what David Emmett said, because he put a fantastic article out about this a couple of weeks ago on his extended version of his website. If you're not subscribed to David Emmett on Patreon, I highly recommend you do. It's €5 a month for all the insight you could ever imagine out of him that you don't get on the Paddock Pass. Highly, highly recommended. It's the best €5 you'll spend in motorsport journalism on a monthly basis. And please pay for your motorsport journalism. We need the goddamn money. Anyway, the point I'm getting at is if you read his article from a couple of weeks ago, basically, the crux of it has been is that Dorna/MSEG wants to essentially keep their current model going. If you don't know what that is, it means paying the factories a one-off €7 million a year subsidy to cover some of their operating costs year on year, and that's the end of the conversation. That's your financial support. That's the end of it, right? The manufacturers last year basically said, we know you're making a lot more money than that. We want our fair share out of that pie. And that's when talks began about some kind of F1 Concorde-esque agreement. This was about a year ago now. They still haven't gotten this deal done. Liberty Media is now on the brink of intervening in this deal, saying, why hasn't this been done yet, basically. And Dorna basically came back and said, how about $8 million? And that's about as far as it's gotten.
Yeah. Three of our five manufacturers have simply decided we're not negotiating with you unless you start talking to us in good faith. And thus, there has been no discussion because there's been no good faith argument here.
Yeah, Honda and Ducati have apparently agreed on those terms. They're okay with that financial.
Can't imagine
package.
Why.
Because they're Honda and Ducati.
And they have all the money in the world.
They do not care
about getting paid.
They have more money than God, and they're here to race. It's like Ferrari. Ferrari will never quit Formula One. That's their bread and butter. That's the backbone. That's the DNA of their company. They will kick and moan about things that don't go their way, but they will never quit because they're here to race. Mm-hmm. It's that simple. It's the same principle with Honda and Ducati. It doesn't matter what financial package they get because they're going to fucking race anyway. It's Aprilia, a KTM factory that's got one foot out of the door. Rumors getting more and more concrete that Tech Free are leaving to switch to Hondas. So KTM will be down to just their factory team going forward. And Aprilia, who famously don't have a load of money. So
they're having to put everything they've got into their wind tunnel.
Yeah, they are an F1 team in all but name, just a very small one. I can't say I'm shocked, because let's be frank, Dorna reminds me a lot of the UFC. And for those who don't know their mixed martial arts, I'll let you in on a little bit of the numbers here, right? Cam can relate to this more because he's an American and this is how American sports do their shit. The big four in America, baseball, hockey, basketball, and football, they have a CBA, a collective bargaining agreement between the franchise owners and the players' associations in their respective leagues about how the revenue gets divvied up. Typically, it's around 50-50. There's a little bit, there's a few percentage points either way. It depends on the grounds and negotiations and whatnot. There's back and forth, but it's typically around 50-50. The reason why I pulled up the UFC as an example is because it's well known they underpay their fighters. Cam, do you know what percentage of Zuffa, their parent company, how much of the revenue in the UFC goes towards the actual fighters?
I have no idea.
12%.
Mm.
Not 40. Not 30.
Not a whole lot.
12%. Where all the other major American sports, it's 50-50. The UFC has been getting away with murder for a long, long time.
Literally, and
service charges included, apparently. And I think Dawn is very much the same way. They got away. They only brought in this subsidies package for the factory teams, I want to say 8 years ago or something. I think it was around 2016 they brought that in. Before that, the manufacturers got nothing. They got nothing out of the parent company for being there. So, like, they were making all the revenue that the sport was making by hosting MotoGP and having its rights. And the manufacturers, given, and I think a part of this is seeing the fact that Liberty Media now owns them, seeing the growth that Formula One has had in the last decade. It was a £6 billion sport when Liberty bought them. It's now allegedly worth somewhere in the region of $20 billion, according to Forbes. So, you know, nearly four times the value in the space of the last 8-9 years. They now want a slice of that pie because the pie is a lot bigger than they realize, and there's enough to go around. But I personally think that MSEG are being greedy as shit about this. That's
they don't want to share. There's enough pie to go around, but they want it all to themselves. I can't imagine where I've heard this one before.
Oh, I don't know. The crux of it is they've got until the French Grand Prix coming up next weekend. That's the deadline for their current deal. If not, everybody walks away from the table. I don't think this is going to happen.
Yeah, I think the simple solution for the manufacturers, well, we're just not going to sign it.
The fact that the factories, apparently there was a dinner on Friday night in Jerez that the factories are all supposed to roll up to, they all no-showed. Apparently, the situation is now so tense that MSEG are now talking to factories individually instead, because they think there's no chance as a group that they can get there now,
you probably won't see a unified, a Concord agreement. You'll have individualized contracts with each manufacturer. Even that's going to be a bitch to negotiate as well. Because each manufacturer is going to want different compensation. And Honda and Ducati probably just aren't going to care. But KTM, with a foot out the door, very much will. Because if they can make it worth their while to actually compete here, they're going to demand doing so. Yamaha, to that effect, kind of surprises me. Because they have a ton of money themselves. They are, you know, just as much as Honda as anything, here to race.
And the funny thing about that is that the person that was the first person to front this idea was Lynn Jarvis on the way out when he was managing director of Yamaha after 26 years of that team.
What's the operative word there?
Former.
Was.
I'll read a bit of this article out to get the point across here. the manufacturers grouped under the unity of the MSMA, which is the manufacturers of the sport, led by President Massimo Rivola, that's Aprilia's CEO, if you didn't know already, and Lynn Jarvis, former managing director of Yamaha, are asking for a change in the system, leaving behind the current fixed allocation per season to instead become part of the overall business. The constructors understand that MotoGP must be brought in line with other major sports competitions, such as the Champions League in football, the NBA or the NFL, where teams now receive variable amounts depending on results, a percentage of the TV rights, and most importantly, they are part of the governance of the championship when it comes to decision making. So in other words, the manufacturers are all sitting here saying, well, we want a say in how the sport is run and governed. We want a slice of the TV pie because we're the reason you guys compete. This is reasonable from the manufacturers. Every other major global sport runs this way, except for MotoGP.
Well, and reading through the article here, Yamaha is the one most firm against that. Interesting.
Why?
Don't know.
That doesn't make any sense.
They're not
going to
get any TV money. The bike is so bad, they're not going to be seen on television.
Is that why they've lost Monster as a sponsor? I wonder.
I tend to think so.
Because Monster is no longer associated with this Yamaha team. They had to very quietly drop the Monster branding off their social media team.
They're
going to
be gone from the bike sooner rather than later.
Yeah. So Yamaha's in negotiation flux. Dorna are digging their heels in. The Liberty Media is banging on the door saying, why has this not been done yet? And the manufacturers basically want a model that is a lot like most global sports when it comes to governance. This is a mess. And there is no easy answer. And apparently, they've got a week and a half to figure this out. Otherwise, negotiations are going to completely collapse. Apparently, it's unbelievably tense between the business and the manufacturers as we speak.
Yeah, I mean, if they're just not even negotiating as a group now and they've gone to the teams directly, it just doesn't sound like it's going to happen, does it?
I don't think it will. I think both sides are too far apart. If Dorna is
interestingly enough with that too, Dre, think about it. Honda and Ducati have broken with the unity of the Manufacturers Association. That's going to have ramifications down the line.
Yeah, that is, you want a unified stance against this. Your best chance is as a union against the sport itself. And Honda and Ducati are content not to play that game. They are okay with going it alone. Not great. Because I think for the greater good, I think you'd want to get on this wagon and fight the sport for it. Because, yeah, I agree with their overall premise that they want they rightfully are trying to get a bigger slice of the pie. Raptor makes a good point in the chat as well. I wonder how much Aprilia plays a role in this with essentially the fact they announced Marco Bezzecchi's extension before the season even started. Because apparently Rivola was criticized quite heavily for that too, because of the language of the contract. So, there's a lot of niggles. There's a lot of internal beef. There's clearly a lot of intensity around that table that I don't think is going to get settled anytime soon.
Certainly not in a week's time.
And what's in a week's time? The French Grand Prix at Le Mans, over 110,000 expected on race day. One of the real blue ribbon events on the MotoGP calendar now. Looking forward to that. We'll obviously be reviewing that in full in a week and a half's time.
Somehow, I don't think I'm going to put any money down on a Fabio Quartararo home pole position this year.
At least the black will look pretty.
Will it? Will we see it?
Probably not. Before we get out of here, I just want to take a couple of minutes out to say congratulations and a salute to the legend that is Sylvain Guintoli. For those who didn't see it over the course of last weekend, it was the London Marathon this weekend, and ignoring the absolutely fucking ridiculous 1:59:30 that Sebastian Soy ran in a marathon.
Just take a moment that someone broke the two-hour barrier on the marathon for the first time officially and finished second.
Life is not fair. Sport is not fair. Imagine dear running a 1:59:41 in your first ever competitive marathon and not winning.
You get smoked 11 seconds behind.
Yeah. Obviously, most of London Marathon is known for charity and fundraising. And for those who didn't see the horrible news last year, Sylvain Guintoli, most known for being a world superbike champion, a former MotoGP racer, an endurance world champion as well, as well as being a TNT sports pundit. His son Luca tragically passed away due to cancer. He was just 6 years old last year. It was a real, just horrible unifying moment of grief amongst everyone in bike racing. And Sylvain Guintoli wanted to pay tribute to Luca by running the London Marathon in full leathers. The absolute sicko. And he did it in 3 hours 46. What a man to go sub 4 hours in racing leathers. He broke the world record for the fastest marathon in racing leathers. A salute.
Somehow I'm not sure how many people are competing in that category.
I don't think it's a the speedrunners leaderboard list. The leaderboard's probably quite small, but that, nonetheless, an unbelievable achievement. He was racing for the PASIC charity, which is supporting families and formerly families and children that are going through cancer. I will leave a link to donate in the description. I believe you still can. He's raised over £130,000 for charity as a direct result of that. Sylvain, you're a hero. What an absolute legend. Unbelievable achievement. And from all of us at M101, you're an absolute legend. All the proceeds from this episode will go towards that charity as well, because that is fucking phenomenal. All our love to Sylvain and the family, of course. Just remarkable to watch and remarkable to see in real time. Also fun to see Sebastian Vettel gave it a go as well. Ran under sub 3 hours. First marathon, 2:59. What a guy. My God.
What a man.
We'll be back with the French Grand Prix in a week and a half's time. Formula One is back this weekend. The small matter of the Miami Grand Prix this weekend. We're back after 5 weeks away. A lot to talk about on that weekend. It's a sprint weekend, of course, and Formula Two as well. Like the first ever Formula Two race in North America, believe it or not.
Oh God, help us all.
And then I mentioned 80% chance of rain on Sunday.
Well, it's not like we have new power unit rules, heavily updated cars, and it's a sprint weekend.
What could possibly go right? Anyway, until then, I've been Dre Harrison. He's been Cam Buckley. We'll see you next time. Sayonara.
Just one more time for our bikes. It's all I need.
How much our bikes time did we get for this entire weekend? Maybe like 45 seconds?
It was like a big portion of the sprint and then like 30 seconds of the Grand Prix.
Yeah, it's something.